This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the 300th supporter Q&A. Kind of funny that we're hitting 300 this week and hitting 400 on the weekly roundup next week. I'm not sure. You know, if I had tried to plan that, it would have never fallen into place that way. But it's kind of funny how that stuff works out. But 300. Wow. I've enjoyed all of these. They're all a lot of fun. They all feel like just conversations with all of you. And hopefully everybody takes them as I mean them. You know, first and foremost, a thank you to everybody who supports. And also, maybe it's a way to entice more people to join up, just so you know that you're part of a community that's constantly evolving and growing and needs your help, to be honest. So, I don't know, I've loved doing these, and thank you all for letting me make it up to 300 of them. A couple more things before we begin. First, a friendly reminder that this Saturday, the second batch of RetroTINK 4Ks is going on sale. I know a bunch of you are waiting for that, so I wanted to just give you another polite heads up. And also, I had to record these on Wednesday because I have a bunch of stuff coming in Thursday and Friday for videos that I'm working on, behind the scenes testing, all that stuff. So as soon as those arrived, I really wanted to dive in deep and just start getting into that stuff, because I've had a lot of things going on in the background that I want to present to all of you, but it's not done yet and it needs a lot more testing and stuff like that. So I figured I would just do it today. There's already enough questions. So I like to give these my full attention. I don't like to be thinking about something else, even though I'm always working on like 20 things at once. So I figured I would just do it today. So if I missed your question, my apologies, but let's get started with the 300th. First up, over on the YouTube support service, DustyShootman845 say they have a Sony Trinitron KV32, so a very nice Trinitron consumer CRT. And the last time they used it, it was fine. But then they went to play their Genesis the other day, and when they turned it on, the picture on screen is rapidly jumping around. This is happening with multiple consoles and multiple AV ports. When they hooked up the RF picture... Starting strong today, aren't I? When they hooked up the RF picture on their TV, that's nice and steady. They've tried component and composite connections, and then the picture just jumps really fast for those. That's happening with their Genesis, SNES, and PS2. However, their GameCube and PS3 will display just fine when connected through the same AV ports. Their question is, why is their picture rapidly jumping on component and composite? So that's kind of crazy. You know, my gut is telling me that because this is a CRT, it's got to be at least 20 years old. And the thing that always goes in all components is the capacitors. So having it work via RF, but not through component or composite, might just mean that the capacitors around those signals are probably degrading and not syncing on to the image. All that said, though, why would it then work with GameCube and PS3? It's not like it's a 15 kilohertz, 31 kilohertz issue, because that TV can only accept 15 kilohertz, 240p and 480i. So even if your GameCube and PS3 are working, those are going to be in 480i. So your PS2 should work as well, because it's going to be the same type of signal. A couple of questions back for you, though, just to help troubleshoot this. When you say it doesn't work on your PS2, but it does work on your PS3, is it the exact same cables? Are you unplugging the composite or component video cables from the PS2, which is not working, plugging it into the PS3, which is working? That would be very surprising, but I would just try to do a few more things to nail down where the issue is. So often with stuff like this, it is older beat up cables, or the RCA ports on your TV are, you know, too many times have been pushed in, so they're kind of worn out. But it also could just be the circuit board itself. And this is one of those things where if you love that TV, you might want to check out Steve from RetroTech's videos and kind of see if you want to go through and restore that the same way you would any classic piece of electronics. And that would include things like reflowing the jacks for the RCAs to make sure that those are solid, doing a visual inspection to make sure the board's not cracked, because that could potentially be it too. Somebody could have plugged an RCA connector in really hard and slightly cracked the board, and then every time you plug it and plug it back in, it might shift the board a tiny bit, which just would mean randomly sometimes the connection's going to work and sometimes it wouldn't. You could try cleaning off the connectors. Look in, especially if you have a magnifying glass, look in and see if there's any oxidation inside the RCA connectors. That could also explain why RF would be working, because maybe there's no oxidation in that. You could just use really anything to get in there and try to clean that out. Same thing with the connections, the RCA connections on the cables as well. You could probably just plug them in and try gently wiggling them around inside the TV to see if that works, just to see if you get any signal back. But it could also come down to, it's a 20 plus year old TV. It might just need a restoration, especially if you live by the ocean or someplace with lots of humidity or, you know, lots of the salt air or something like that. So you're going to need to do a couple more troubleshooting steps to really determine where the exact point of failure is. And if it does just come down to the composite and component jacks, then you could look into a restoration. But if you start working on CRTs, just know that discharging them is very dangerous. And if you don't discharge it, you could die. It's not very likely. However, there is basically zero chance of you dying when you're modding a Super Nintendo unless you do it in a bathtub or with it plugged into the wall or something like that, whereas that is not the case with CRTs. So it's good to be afraid of them. It's good to be too afraid of them, in fact, because, you know, better to not do something than be careless and zap yourself. And what if you had a heart condition you didn't know about and then that's it? So I always like to err on the side of caution, and I get very annoyed when people say things like, oh, it's fine, it's totally safe. It's not. It's like saying using a chainsaw is totally safe. Sure, if you use all precautions and then don't get careless with it, but it's not safe. It's still a chainsaw, so same thing. But if you do choose to go down that route and you do discharge properly, then it's safe to work on, and then you could do a more thorough visual inspection, see if you want to replace the capacitors, which is very time-consuming, but not too hard, and see if you want to do any of the other work. But yeah, follow up and let us know the other troubleshooting steps you've taken, and we'll see if we can nail it down for you, but you might not get lucky. This might be kind of a tricky one. Next up, over on Patreon, Steven Sanders wants to know what I think about taking a RetroTINK 5X Pro, running that into an M Classic, and then that into a 4K Gamer Pro, into an LG OLED CX or newer. So, if you mean that chain of devices, and then you only turn on the M Classic or the 4K Gamer Pro when you want to, and then leave them off otherwise, I think that would work totally fine. I know the 4K Gamer Pro does definitely have some compatibility issues with not 1080p signals and not fully compliant 1080p signals. So it might not even work when they're all connected like that. But if you're talking about you're sending 1080p to the M Classic and the 4K Gamer Pro, and you just want to turn on the M Classic when you want smooth scaling and the 4K Gamer Pro when you want sharp scaling, yeah, that should work. I have a bunch of opinions on this, though. But to answer your question first, it should work, but I wouldn't turn them on both at the same time, because you'd be first smoothing, then sharp scaling, which doesn't really make sense. I mean, one would cancel the other out. I actually have heard people say that they've done this and it looks good, but my guess is that's not doing anything and it's their mind playing tricks on them. It's the placebo effect, because the M Classic, the way it works and the way it's doing its scaling, it might not actually be doing a full anti-aliasing, and it's kind of complicated when you mix all this stuff together. I wouldn't do it. It's not going to hurt anything though, so if you just want to see what happens, go for it, but you're probably going to get no signal. Now, there's definitely a few things to note about this, and my first very strong opinion, but just an opinion, is if you own an LG OLED CX, that is a gorgeous TV. The LG OLEDs are some of the best TVs ever made, and the CX is known for being good for gaming for a million reasons. So that's the time where you might want to seriously consider selling all three of those and getting a RetroTINK 4K. If you told me you had a budget model LCD TV, I would say you probably don't need to upgrade. Use all three of those. Use them in whatever combination that you want. But honestly, I mean, the better the TV you get, the better the stuff that you should be connecting to it. So this would absolutely be a good excuse to sell all three and use that money towards the Tink 4K, because you just would get so many more options. And while the current beta smoothing isn't quite the anti-aliasing that the M Classic does, I think if you're going 720p to 4K, it's probably a very cool option. I'm going to wait for others to do comparisons on this. Maybe I could get around to it, but I'm not sure if I would have time. But that's, you know, upgrading is definitely part of it, or definitely part of your total solution that you should be thinking about, just because of how good your TV is. Also, the couple of things to remember is the M Classic's anti-aliasing, a lot of that has to do with the source, and as well as the source resolution. And in fact, using that to go to 1440p might actually look better if you're going for some kind of smoothing effect. So I don't know if I would even connect it through the 4K Gamer Pro, just in case its EDID says 1080p only, because that might limit that option. Maybe not, and I've actually never gotten my M cable to work in 1440p for whatever. I haven't tried an EDID spoofer yet, and I guess if you really wanted to, you could add one of those to the chain. But just as a general yes or no, if you had asked me that and said I only had to answer yes or no, you know, Tink 5X Pro into M Classic into 4K Gamer Pro, no. And for all the reasons I just said, you might not want to, into the LG OLED CX, I wouldn't waste my time messing around with all of this stuff, because you could find a scenario in which maybe even mixing them together makes one game look better, but I doubt it. I think using only one at a time is the proper way to do it. And getting a better scaler overall for that amazing TV is probably the best overall option. But hopefully I answered it properly. You know, facts first, opinion second, and let me know if you want me to elaborate anymore. Although I think I covered it. Next up, Brian Greenslate wanted to follow up with the conversation last week about dumping the stuff found on a Satellaview memory card. And they used the Save the Hero cart reader, the Sani cart reader project, and it worked, but they had part of the BS Zelda game, not F-Zero. So I actually didn't realize that you could just dump those right with the Sani cart reader. That's pretty incredible. I thought maybe you might need some extra tools or something like that, but thank you very much for letting us know. That is very, very cool. And now I know what to recommend in the future, because I do like those cart readers. I have one myself, and I've been using it and really haven't had any trouble with it. So yeah, thanks for following up. Next up, Steve Wells wanted to chime in on the discussion of using different kind of plastic polishes to fix up older consoles. And Steve said they used Armor All Cream Cut and Polish to polish their Wii and Xbox 360, and both resulted in a near-mirror finish. The only reason they chose that is because they already had a bottle floating around, but it seemed to have good results. They just wouldn't use it on anything with a slightly textured casing or anything not intended to be shiny, so like a Super Nintendo or something like that. So I definitely appreciate the suggestion and letting us know. And that's one of those things that I think we almost need a deep dive video. We need like a My Life in Gaming or a Macho Nacho production video where they show a bunch of those different polishes and then have nice macro shots showing the plastic. Maybe they can find an old cracked and yellowed Super Nintendo or something to show what not to do, because the case is already destroyed anyway. So I would love to see a deep dive on that. And I'm sure there's going to be many right ways. So you mentioned the Armor All brand, but there's probably 10 other brands that do it just as well. However, I'm positive there's going to be times where you use this type of polish on this finish, just as you said already. So I would love to see somebody do a deep dive video, or, you know, maybe there is one brand that really has all the products they need. And if so, they should sponsor My Life in Gaming or Macho Nacho's video to do this so we could all learn about it. But I definitely appreciate the heads up. I think that there should be some kind of definitive guide out there, though, and hopefully one of the bigger players in retro would be willing to talk about this and show some examples. And I could definitely, if anybody wants to, I could probably get some beat up, destroyed old cases that there was no chance of it being restored anyway. So feel free to make worse by using what not to do demonstrations on them. Next up, Tom M wants to know what controller I recommend using with the Mister. They have snack stuff, but they're kind of a pain, especially when they just want to play something. So what are my top picks on wired or wireless options, and what do I typically look for? So when I want to use original controllers, I use any of the MacGyver-based adapters. I'll leave a link to the ones that Greg sells. They're, you know, he's fully compliant with the open source terms, and they're very high quality. But you could basically use Genesis and SNES on the on Greg's, or if Mick has them in stock on the Damon Byte website, there's many other consoles. But they're essentially less than 1 millisecond of latency, and you just use your original controllers. So if that's what you were looking for wired options, then that would be my first choice. Anything past that, though, my next step. So if you that's what you want to use is original wired controllers, that would be step one. If you're looking for third party, then step one should be check any latency database or any controller, anything that talks about controllers and has actual measured latency on it. I'll leave a link to the one that most of us use. But then I would sort by latency and then by wired or wireless and choose from there. Now, you mentioned Bluetooth. Bluetooth used to be really laggy, but thanks to things like Blue Retro and just certain controller brands being better, that's not always the case nowadays. For example, you can get a Bluetooth receiver for your mister and use a PlayStation 5 controller, and it's less than half a frame, which I think is totally fine in almost all scenarios. Plus, you have all the advantages of the PS5 controller, the dual analog sticks, the touchpad, all the awesomeness that you would expect from that. But that's basically it for me. If you want original controllers, I would look for the MacGyver-based adapters. And then if you want third-party controllers, start with latency and go from there. They have like USB, SNES, and Genesis style controllers, but really I would start by picking out based on lag first, because there are some, like you mentioned the 8-bit DOE controllers, some of their controllers are very fast and others aren't, so you're going to need to check the latency database to see which is which. But yeah, that's basically it, and I put my favorites in the Mr. page, so I'll leave a link to all of that stuff if you're interested. But yeah, I totally understand your snack complaints, because even if you have those adapters that have to plug into another adapter that has to plug into another adapter, you still need to use a different way to access the menus. So I personally only use snack for light guns now, or any time that you need something like that. I think some of the MIDI stuff might require it. But any other time, I would just use the MacGyver adapters, because 1 millisecond or less of latency is absolutely zero. And I know every time I say that, somebody gets confused and they think I'm talking about frames. 1 millisecond of latency is zero to a human computer interface. There is no possible way that could affect your gameplay at all. And if anybody says 1 millisecond can, they're lying. They're trying to blame their lost Smash tournament on something other than their skills. So, you know, always brutally honest here. I'd rather have you mad at me for telling the truth than have you mad because I just scooted around the issue because I was afraid to upset somebody. But yeah, that's how I would recommend it. And let me know what you think. Richard Kingston wanted to follow up from the question of last week about getting an N64 with RGB and composite, and then wanted to clarify and say that their N64 is not yet modded. They were just wondering if anybody had heard of an easier or cheaper way to get composite video into an RGB line. Nope, everything I said last week still stands. Just get a sync on composite video cable, and that's all you need to use. And in fact, if you were going to composite via SCART, you could just use that cable on an unmodded N64, because it would then just pull composite video on the sync line. So everything I said last week stands, I don't want to repeat myself and waste people's time, but yeah, that's exactly how I would do it. I would just get a standard sync on composite cable, fully shielded, and then whenever you get the RGB mod done, you just don't even need to worry about anything else. Next up, Arcade UK has been messing around with GameCube games via Dolphin on a Mac, and now they want to try original hardware, so they'd like to get a PAL GameCube running on their LG 4K TV. They were going to start with an unmodded PAL console and a RAD 2X, but they're anticipating their TV being sluggish at upscaling the 480p signal. So two things right there. The maximum signal a RAD 2X can accept is 480i, and the maximum signal that a GameCube could output is 480p. So you would definitely be better off getting a solution that gets 480p out of it, so you don't have to do any deinterlacing. Now, that said, I don't think LG TVs would add a ton of lag to their 480p signal. The ones that I've had, my OLED and then just my cheap bottom model LCD, don't really have a difference when you're scaling 480p or 1080p. It's basically the same thing. So I wouldn't worry about that unless you've already tested yours with a time sleuth or you know somebody who has and you've confirmed your model doesn't do a good job 480p scaling. But LG TVs are usually pretty good about that. Next, they have an original version 1 OSSC, and they haven't used it for years, but they want to know if that could be used to double the 480p signal. Absolutely. So you could either find yourself some component cables, or you can get one of those devices like the Carby, and then you could get an HDMI to component video converter, and then send that to the OSSC to go to 1080p. However, you're going to want to start with something like a Carby, so I would pick up one of those and just try it into your TV first. There is an excellent chance it's going to look fine as is, just in 480p with not much latency. But if that's the case, if you end up doing it and then you don't like the way it looks, or you know, maybe you feel it could be sharper, or you think that there's more latency, sure, just get yourself a cheap DAC, digital to analog converter, send that to component video and go right into, or I guess even VGA if you wanted, go right into the OSSC and let that line double it to 960p, and then your TV would then bring it to 4K. And I've had very good luck doing that with LG TVs. If not, are there any simpler devices available in the UK that would perform that task? Not really. I mean, nothing that I would recommend other than, you know, of course you could pick up a higher end scaler, but if you're talking about trying to pick up devices without breaking the bank, I would just start with a Carby. And also, does the RAD 2X allow them to upscale any original discs? And would it be compatible with Swiss? Neither of those things matter. And I'm not being rude about that. I just mean that literally. Like, the RAD 2X just takes whatever the signal, and same thing with the Carby, whatever the signal's coming out of there, and converts it to HDMI. So if you used original discs, you would have to manually enable 480p for games that supported it. If you used Swiss, you could just force 480p on basically every game. But the video output solution that you use isn't going to be affected by that. If you get video out of the console, then those solutions will work. But I'll leave a link to the Carby, and hopefully that's all that you would need for this, to be honest. Next up, Nick has a white PC engine that wasn't really working, so they took the suggestion of getting the EDFX, and now while it works, the colors are all wrong, and some of the layers and colors seem to be missing from every game they try. They actually found an old RF modulator that they took from a Mega Drive a while back, and when they put that on the PC engine, they got the RF signal working on their TV, but with the exact same layer and color issues as with the EDFX. So I have good news and bad news for you. The good news is excellent nerding. Those are exactly the type of troubleshooting steps that I would have asked you to do. Bad news is that means there's something wrong with the console. If you're getting crazy color and layer outputs or layer issues from both outputs, then that means there's something wrong on the board itself. And it could be a long number of things. I've seen that IDE cable thingy that's in there connecting the top board and the bottom go bad quite often. I've seen some of the chips go bad. So you're going to want to try to find any PC Engine experts for people who have troubleshooted this exact thing. And if anybody's listening and you know the answer, please just chime in the comments. But it sounds like it's going to be a much harder issue to fix. The good news is the EDFX is still awesome. So if you end up having to get another one, then that's still the solution I would have told you to get anyway. But yeah, you're probably going to have to dig in. I mean, you could try seeing if a capacitor replacement would fix it, but I doubt it. This is not a sign of bad caps, usually. This is more of a sign of something much worse going wrong. So one of the main chips on it, that board, whatever else. So, you know, definitely pop it open and do a visual inspection. I've seen those boards with cracks in them, so that there could be some physical damage. If you open it up and you separate the top two boards, but kind of turn it on and try it that way, which be careful, you don't want to short anything out, but I've definitely seen that work. And then when you flex the cable, if it starts working, that obviously means it's the cable issue, which is a giant pain to replace anyway, but you're going to have some hard work in front of you, but at least you were able to do a good job nailing the issues down. So sorry, I don't have better news for you, Nick, but hopefully you can get that up and running. Next up, Sal has really been wanting a Bang & Olufsen CRT to complete their setup for a long time, specifically an MX-5000. They can't seem to get one of these in the US, and apparently the streets of Denmark are lined with B&Os. People swim in pools of MXs like Scrooge McDuck. They have a contact in Denmark that might be able to get me one, but what are the thoughts regarding shipping this to the US? Roughly, what is the ballpark cost to do this? So I have no idea, but it's going to be really, really expensive. like to the point that you could probably get a calibrated BVM for much cheaper than just the shipping. Because you would need to pallet it. You would need to not only put it on a pallet, you'd have to have it strapped in, but you'd also still want to do all of the stuff that we do when shipping CRTs. Like here's where the pool float things, a couch cushion, all the duct tape in the world just to get all this together, and then also pallet it and then hope that it survives the journey. But don't forget that a lot of times pallets are dropped. And even though it's not dropped from the side of a building, if pallets are getting loaded and they're dropped 2 feet off the ground, you've just dropped a CRT 2 feet off the ground. So if you have the money, and this is something that's very important to you, do it, but use a shipper that will absolutely insure it. And then I would call and just say like, hey, you know, how do I prove that this thing is working beforehand so that if you break it, I can get all of my shipping refunded to me, and just try to get that proved out. But honestly, if you're really just looking for a really high-end CRT, DM me, just DM me right through the Patreon app and I could put you in touch with Steve, or I know of a few for sale. I have some coming up here that I'm going to have to sell pretty soon. So, and I'm not, by the way, I'm not saying don't buy that to give me money instead. I'm just being honest. The money that you're going to spend on shipping one of those over, you could get yourself a BVM and you might like that more depending on your use case. So I would definitely really think about it if you, and make sure that you want to spend this kind of money. But hey, who knows? Maybe you're a crypto billionaire and you just want one of every CRT. And if that's the case, just find somebody to pack it insanely well on a pallet, and then find a company that is willing to definitely prove to you that they're going to refund you your shipping money if it doesn't arrive safely. Because generally speaking, if they're that confident, it's going to arrive safely, most likely. Whereas if they're going to give you the runaround, like I forgot who was the company that screwed me over pretty bad a couple of years ago, but there was one where I paid for the insurance and they just denied everything. And I fought them the whole time and they just basically were like, no, it's up to us, not you. So too bad that you bought the insurance. It didn't matter. It was a US company. I forgot who it was, but I'll see if I could remember and add it to the description. But I would definitely check beforehand. Next up, Koala Koa had a question about running a Sega Saturn through an Extron crosspoint. And this one threw me for a loop, so I contacted Koala directly to make sure that I had the information correct, because it all seemed kind of odd. And the issue is that Koala had an RGB SCART cable and one of those retro gaming cables, component video cables for the Saturn. And both of them worked perfectly when connected directly to the RetroTINK 4K or directly into a PVM. However, when ran through the Extron crosspoint to those target devices, there was either no signal at all or just jumbled signal or whatever. So I think the issue with the SCART cable is that it's a sync on Luma SCART cable, which means that's not going to work for a crosspoint. You would probably want to get a C-Sync version of that, or you could get a BNC adapter with a sync stripper. I don't really like to use that unless you need to, but it's certainly a possibility. But I have no clue why the component video cables wouldn't work. So I'm going to try to work this out offline with Koala, but I wanted to ask all of you, how many of you have either HD Retrovision component or retro gaming cable component cables and are successfully running them through an Extron crosspoint? Because I am 99.9% sure that my Saturn worked perfect through my crosspoint setup with HD Retrovision cables, but that was over a year ago, and I've changed the setup 20 times already, so I don't really know for sure. So yeah, definitely let me know if anybody has had any issues with this, and I'll follow back up once we kind of figure out what's happened. Next up, Rent Optional noticed some people talking about the micro USB port on the Super G switch is breaking. And the issue is that if a cord gets tugged or if the connector is pushed in too far, the connector gets ripped off and it'll take the solder pads with it. So I have owned and very heavily used every single version of the G switch, and I've never had that happen. I'm kind of a meathead sometimes with this stuff. However, some of the people that I've seen complaining are people that I trust that definitely know what they're doing. They're not the type to just manhandle something and then blame the creator. In fact, the opposite. They're the types to be like, I'm an idiot, look what I did. So when they say, hey, this wasn't my fault, I believe them because, I mean, they just, that's how they roll. But the issue is, I don't really know where to start with this because, like I said, I have just never had this issue ever with my switches. And it could be that something got changed in manufacturing. It could be that the manufacturer swapped out a part at the last second because of the part shortage. So one run is worse than the others. I really just don't know. I do know that the reason for changing it from barrel jack to USB was because a lot of people blew out their switches using the wrong polarity power cable, which originally Super G thought it would be really easy because I think he just picked one that was compatible with all Genesis One power supplies. So even those kind of cheap ones that I wouldn't recommend for consoles would probably be fine for this because it's such a low power draw. But I think a lot of people used that one incorrectly, and that's why it was swapped. Next question, is it possible for a modder to swap out the power connector to a barrel jack? I think so. I think, in fact, I think you could pretty easily do that even if the pads get, well, a modder who knows what they're doing could pretty easily do that even if the pads get ripped off. And you could probably just mount the barrel jack or some other connector to the case itself on the inside, obviously. So that way you don't even have to touch or drill or mount anything to the PCB. So they should be repairable. But I think, you know, this is something that should be addressed in manufacturing as well. And I know Super G's been really busy and hasn't really been dealing with switches lately. I think he kind of passed that design off just to be sold. But maybe a design revision that just switches that to maybe a USB-C connector and one that's a through-hole design and maybe one that comes with some mounting protection built in would probably be a good idea. But I also just think that the amount of people who own those versus the amount of people who have them break is definitely a small percentage. However, you can't ignore the fact that somebody just spent a lot of money on what's supposed to be the most premium switch out there that broke. So I see both sides, and I'm, as usual, directly in the middle of this stuff. You know, I'm always on the side of the consumer, but I see from a developer standpoint how easy it would be just to say, hey, thousands of these haven't broken, so I'm sorry about the couple. Let's try to figure this out. Now, I know there have been a couple of different community-made solutions for these. There's the Laser Bear bumpers. Somebody else made, I think, a 3D print specifically for this. And while I love all community efforts like that, this is really something that should be dealt with in manufacturing. So if you have one and it's already working, I wouldn't even think about it. I would just be careful when connecting the power jack, but I certainly don't think it would be something that you'd have to worry about in an existing working setup. And if you're just getting one or if you're moving your setup around, I would be very careful and maybe even get one of those bumpers if that's what you're into. But I'll see if I could talk to Super G and see if he'd be willing to work on some kind of board revision to change this in the future. Because, you know, it's just the bottom line is if they're breaking and it's more than one or two people, then it's a problem. Period. So as much as I think Super G is freaking awesome, a problem's a problem. So I'll message and see what we think. But yeah, I as far as people with units who broke that are within a reasonable warranty period, I would hope that the seller of those switches would be able to swap that out for you. You know, whether it's have it repaired or drop ship a new one with a return label for the old one or something like that. But the part shortage messed up a lot of people. So sellers that would normally have extra stock of things probably hasn't for a while, or getting them repaired might take months because you still need new parts to come in. And while there isn't a part shortage now, we're still feeling the reverberations of that. So that's not an excuse, but it is a valid explanation as to why some of this stuff might be taking longer. So to anybody who got their switch broken, you know, I'm sorry that you went through that, but I'll kind of reach out and see if there's anything I could do to help. But if you have a local modder that's mildly good at this stuff, they should be able to just swap that over to whatever you need, USB-C, whatever else. And you could even do something like wire in a pigtail. So you have a longer USB-C receptacle cable, and you kind of tie that around one of the posts so that for strain relief, and then solder the other side directly in. Yeah, pigtail doesn't look the best, but it's a very cheap and very easy solution for any modder that, you know, any modder you could find for that. And once again, I know it's a shitty thing for me to say if you just spent that much money on a switch and it broke to say, go pay a modder to add a pigtail connector for you. But it's also a pretty easy solution if you wanted it fixed right away and didn't want to have to deal with any of that stuff. So yeah, I don't know. I'll reach out and see what I could do, but that does suck because those really are amazing switches and I have them in my setups, and I'm actually going to be doing a video soon about my new setup that I've had because I've had to downsize, but I haven't, I still have some cool stuff to show and all of them are using G switches. So yeah, sorry for everybody who dealt with that, but hopefully we can get it fixed. Well, that's it for the 300th Q&A. so cool that I got to be able to do all of these, and I really do appreciate all of you. And at the end of these, I always say thank you, and I hope it doesn't cheapen it that I say thank you every week, because I really do mean it. There's nothing I could possibly say that I don't say every week anyway to try to push that point forward. You know, thank you all so much. There's no way we could make all of this awesome stuff happen without your support. So really, just thank you for allowing me to do this, and hopefully these Q&As have been at least a mildly passable thank you to just thank everybody for all their support. So as always, I will see you next week, and thanks again, and wow, 300.